The Guardian.
This podcast is sponsored by audible.co.uk, the number one online destination for digital audiobooks.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
It is a young me who takes to the hot shingle with a notebook and a canvas windbreak in order to be hypnotized by the everlasting waves repetitively coming my way but never quite reaching me, and by the immensity of the water behind them. They make land seem a very trivial business. Benjamin Britten, Lewistoftian from day one, might be said to come out of the sea like one of those oceanic beings who blow horns in the cartouches of ancient maps. Unlike me, he was oceanic from the start. Tides accompany his pulse, whereas my pulse is out of tune with the regular beat of the shore, which I find wearying as well as stimulating. I've never seen Ben tired. He's either fully awake or sound asleep. His father's house stared hard at the sea in all weathers. He had a basement from which on Monday wash day, steam would billow in soapy clouds which added to the morning mist, his sister Beth told me. It is odd how disconnected bits of human information become free from one's unforgetfulness and gain importance. And thus the Lowestoft dentist's house and the little boy on wash day and the composing, like Mozart.
Summer has finally arrived, so we're going to spend this week by the sea, at Aldborough, home to Benjamin Britten, whose centenary is being celebrated this year. This Suffolk seaside town is where that tireless 90-year-old man of letters, Ronald Blythe, spent some of the 50s learning his trade and mingling with the greats. He relives the experience in his memoir, The Time by the Sea, Aldborough, 1955-58. Patrick Barkham went to visit him.
In 1955, a shy librarian named Ronald Blythe was encouraged to move here, to Aldborough, to write his first novel. Befriended by the painter John Nash and his wife Christine, Blythe took his tentative first steps into an extraordinary creative world. He became friends with E.M. Forster, Imogen Holst, daughter of Gustav, and Benjamin Britten, the pianist and composer whose centenary is celebrated this year with more than 1,500 events around the world, including a film, concerts, and Blythe's own memoir, The Time by the Sea. A penniless writer, Blythe was overdrawn by £25 and so found a job, assistant to the organiser of Britten's Aldborough Festival. The festival needed a competent office worker. It got, as Blythe put it, a financially illiterate novelist. Within a week of moving to Aldborough, Blythe passed an old man in the snow, E.M. Forster. Invited to come for a drink with Forster at Britten's house, Blythe became what he calls a listener to the fascinating, brilliant, and sometimes temperamental artists in this seaside enclave. Aldborough was an early creative inspiration for Blythe. A prolific essayist, novelist and author, most famously of Aikenfield, his portrait of a Suffolk village, Blythe is still writing today, aged 90.
Perhaps we could start by telling me a bit about your first meeting with E.M. Forster, because you'd gone to Aldborough to write your first novel, hadn't you? And you passed him in the snow.
Well, amazingly, really, because I was completely unknown as I was very young as a writer. A friend had found me this kind of Victorian bungalow in which at Thorpe Ness,
After about a week, I walked into Walborough, which is quite a long way, to get some food. And when I got back, there was a page torn from a diary pushed under the door, which hadn't got a letterbox, from E.M. Forster, of all people, and it said, would I like to go and have a drink with him that evening? And he was living for a week or two in Benjamin Britten's house. So Forster let me in. He was with a friend of his from Cambridge called Professor Sprott. They were doing the index to Marion Thornton, which was the biography Forster was writing about his aunt, from whom came the money which allowed him to be a writer, not have to get a job sort of thing. Because I'd worked in a library, I knew how to do indexing. They weren't very good at it, I might say. And they asked me kind of questions, but I didn't dare say I was going to be a writer. I can't remember much about it, except for the fact that they asked me what I was reading, and I said Elizabeth Bowen. I thought she was the most wonderful writer. Then I worried, because they looked at each other over my head, as it were. There's a thing which happens sometimes with certain people, that a young person is there, and they're amused by him in some way, but they don't explain. And they make you feel a little bit shy, in effect. For the next 2 or 3 weeks, when I came into Aldborough to do the shopping and things like that, Forster would appear, just a kind of amazed that this, to me, great author should talk to me at all.
One thing that you wrote about was he always wore incredibly drab clothes and you wondered where they came from.
They're sort of kind of clothes you couldn't imagine where you could buy them, perhaps in a pawn shop or something, I don't know. They weren't dirty, they were just frousty. And his famous cap, which he wore all the time. He was extraordinarily kind to me. But I can't remember telling him I was going to be a writer or I was writing a novel and short stories. I felt I was in awe of him, really.
So you were too intimidated to discuss the craft of writing with him?
No, I didn't say anything like that at all.
Now, your formal entrance into Aldborough Artistic Society, I suppose, came about. There's a lovely story that you tell when you were overdrawn by £25, I think, at the bank, a classic penniless writer, and it was arranged for you to have a job interview, essentially to become assistant to the organiser of Aldborough Festival. And Benjamin Britten appeared at this interview with Peter Pears, and they were both wearing shorts, and I think you felt rather overdressed. But tell me about that first interview with Benjamin Britten.
The woman, Elizabeth Sweeting, who had helped to organise the first 9 years of the festival, was leaving. And so they were appointing a man called Stephen Rice, who I think ran for about 12 years, a very efficient person, which I wasn't, I might say. But they appointed an assistant for £150.
And what were your first impressions of Benjamin Britten? He comes across as quite a serious person in your memoirs.
He was. He was extraordinarily kind to me. And also kind of strict. If you made some little tiny mistake, you would correct it, like by a schoolmaster almost. The person who helped me most was Imogen Holst, who was one of the directors of the festival, and who was a totally different person. She was very used to young people, and in fact, she'd been teaching at Dartington, and she was a kind of inspirational person, and I actually adored her, and I did masses and masses of work with her. And she allowed me to do quite a lot of, I suppose, editing and literary work for the festival. Eventually, when I became a writer, much later, when various books had been published, Benjamin Britten, I used to meet. Both he and Peter Pears, very literary. They read an enormous amount, and they knew a lot about poetry, setting great poems by John Donne and people like that. And I think this literary aspect of my life sort of chimed in with that.
You write really interestingly about the sea and its influence on artists and how Benjamin Britten, as you say, came out of the sea.
It hadn't occurred to me at the time that there's a huge difference between what you might call an inlander and somebody born on the coast, wherever it happens to be. And I'd only been to the sea for little holidays, really, but I didn't know much about it at all. And also to be with Ben, who was born at Lowestoft, within yards of the sea. He'd heard it all his life, really. First of all, he lived at Snape Mill before he met Peter, but then they both lived right by the sea. So this noise of the sea is quite noisy to see it at Aldborough because of this shingle ridge. These millions of stones are constantly moving They're very like music almost. I think that Ben had heard this noise in his head always. In Suffolk, we have a long stretch of land about 10 miles wide called the Sandlings, and it goes right up to Norfolk. And it has a different ecology. It has different plants, it has different birds, it has a different wind, etc. And I think Ben belonged to that climate, whereas I was born in West Suffolk, near Lavenham, which is a different world altogether. I hadn't realised this when I went to live there at all, and I was enthralled by it. The only thing I couldn't quite get over was being so cold. I couldn't, and they didn't seem to feel the cold. They didn't shut the doors of their houses or anything like that. I felt the cold all the time in the wind, but at the same time I was thrilled by it because I was a great walker, and I had botanist friends walking about all the time, and also I was very poor.
Mm-hmm. And you were actually a little bit homesick for...
I was a bit, yes.
Inland.
Inland, that's right. Yes, I was.
For the softness of
it. I love this sort of wonderful East Anglian villages and architecture and the fields. And...
You met and befriended so many interesting artists in the 1950s in Aldeburgh. Why do you think the town became such a focus for creativity?
Well, it was Peter Pears who suggested the festival. Before the festival, just after the war, there was a thing called SEMA, which was a kind of travelling concerts, theatre and things like that. And they had big buses full of scenery and stage things. And Ben and Peter and other artists were travelling about in wrecked towns and villages and cities of Germany, putting on concerts. And it was absolutely wearing. Eric Crozier was with them too. And it was Eric Crozier who suggested once when they were in Aldeburgh, why don't they just put on the work in the Jubilee Hall there, which seated about 300 or 400 people. And that's how it all began.
And Eric Crozier had a big falling out with Benjamin Britten.
Yes, but I actually genuinely don't know why. Perhaps I should have asked in a way, but I didn't. You have to remember, in those days, I felt very inferior to them all. I was just a sort of person who was doing all kinds of jobs for them. The other thing was, to be quite honest, I was immersed in literature, writing, and with these writer friends. I was less interested in what they were doing than in becoming a writer.
Both he and Imogen Holst had this talent for bringing children out of themselves.
But she was the
inspiring
one who did
that. Young people.
She'd been at Dartington, and he read a lot for children. And it was she who got the Suffolk children to sing in like Noise Flood. And she was a genius, really. She was enchanting too. She was a very plain woman, so plain that she was beautiful, if you know what I mean, extraordinary. I adored her, and we became close friends, really. And I admired her, and she worked like 20 hours a day. She did all the orchestration for Britten.
There was an interesting little observation in your book where you mentioned that Benjamin Britten's house was overlooked by the seawall, and people would gather on the seawall to watch him work.
His house wasn't all that big, built about 1912. And it faced the sea. By this time, I think people were asking where he lived. And you could stand on the wall and look into his house, or you just look at it as you're walking past. He put up a little kind of fence. He just had a shingle garden, some stones. It's quite small. The house was very strong looking, as all the houses along the front were. But there was no escape, because the back just went up into a street. And the garden wasn't as big as this room, really. He sat outside sometimes. Anyway, when I was there, he changed houses with Mary Potter. She had just divorced her husband, Stephen Potter, and she bought the Red House, which had been a farm near the golf course. Mary, wonderful artist, been there perhaps a year, I don't know. She didn't like it either. So she'd built a studio in the garden of the Red House. So she went back to live there, and she and Ben and Peter lived very happily, I think.
And so he found more seclusion there.
Oh, yes, completely secluded. You could see the sea in the distance.
When you found deserved acclaim for Aikenfield when it was published in the late 60s, how did your creative and artistic friends in Aldborough react? Were they very pleased for you?
Yes. I had written two or three books before Aikenfield, so I was already becoming known as a writer. And I'd also written lots of stories in literary magazines and things like that. But Aikenfield did make a lot of difference, really, yes. In early 1970s, the festival was 25 years old, and Ben asked me to do an anthology of all the writings and things about the festival for Faber and Faber, which I did. Ben and I had to sign, and Peter Pears and Imogen, 100 copies for £10. And Benjamin Britten said, nobody's going to buy a book for £10.
And did they?
It sold out, of course.
Yeah. That's right. While Blythe was busy working for Britain in Aldborough, he became homesick for his old friends inland. He made regular trips to Bottengoms, the remote farmhouse on the border of Suffolk and Essex, where John Nash the painter and his wife Christine lived. Now, more than 55 years on, it is Blythe's home after John left it to him when he died. We're here at Ronald Blythe's home, Bottengoms, which is a gorgeous old farmhouse on the borders of Suffolk and Essex. And it's a lovely tranquil spot, and I can hear a chiff-chaff in the background there, and there's a beautiful garden here too. But Ronald, just describe to me briefly the farm itself and its history.
Well, it's a typical kind of East Anglian family farm of about 70 acres. And it wasn't farmed after the 1920s. And bit by bit, the old house, which is kind of about 1600, didn't fall to pieces, was just abandoned, as many of them were, particularly when I was young. And then John Nash started painting in this valley, which is what is called the Constable country. The Constables actually ground the corn from this house. He knew it from 1929, John did. And came painting here in August, usually. He was a great botanist, soils, growing plants in this little place, which is all overgrown. So he bought it. And not long after that, I had met Sir Cedric Morris, the artist, and he introduced me to the Nashes who'd come to live here. That's how it all began. He's in a terrible state, really. Didn't worry her remotely. He only had oil lamps, even when I first came here, and candles. The whole atmosphere was inside, like an Eric Revilliers painting, in a sense. And it had that kind of feeling to it. A lot of music they both played. And their artist friends came. There were lots of cats. And there was a little group of us all, really, all knowing each other and all painting and writing.
And you'd met Christine at Colchester Library, where you were a reference librarian.
Yes, she came in. She wanted the miniature score of Idomeneo. She was saying, would you like to come and have tea with us here? And that's how it began. And I remember walking down the track. It's about half a mile, a stony track down to this house.
And you spent all this time with these visual artists, but you yourself were a poet and an aspiring writer. How did they help you with that? Christine was a big support, was she, for that, for your ambitions?
Yes, she was. I dedicated my first book to her, a novel. She had no patience with people who played safe or anything like that. Through her, I left the library on a regular job, as Mother called it, and went to live on the Suffolk coast.
And that was obviously your entrance into Aldborough society, but you were homesick and you regularly came to see the Nashes at Bottengoms here.
I wasn't so much homesick as I was uncomfortable in a way. I remember Christine buying me a paraffin heater. It seemed to be easier and cosier, and at that time I suppose I needed the moral support of people who were living like the person who was most influential, a novelist and poet called James Turner. But he and his wife went to live in Cornwall. Although I did love going to Cornwall and staying there, as I did every year with friends down there. I became a great friend of Charles Causley, the poet. But somehow or other, I just hung around here.
You cared for John Nash in old age, and he left you Bottingholms, the farm, so you inherited it from the Nashes. Does it feel a big responsibility to be living in a house? I know it's your house now, it has been for many decades, but does it feel a big responsibility to be tending for John Nash's garden here? And
well, it does, really. I remember John saying when he was dying, really, he said, what will you do down here? And I said, look after your garden. I couldn't think what else to say, which I've done very dutifully, I might say. I used to garden for them a lot. It's a semi-wild garden.
Now, the other fascinating artistic circle in which you moved in the 1950s was Sir Cedric Morris and his partner Arthur Lett Haynes, who founded the East Anglian School of Painting, where Lucian Freud studied and Maggie Hambling.
Lucian was his first pupil almost. And they started as Hadley, is about 12 miles from here, in an old farmhouse, which is a similar house that's only about twice as big. And they started this school of painting and drawing. And I think it was like £3 a week, bring your own sheets.
They had had an extraordinary life together, hadn't they? Living in Paris, and Arthur Lett Haynes was friends with Hemingway and D.H. Lawrence and Gertrude Stein. Was it intimidating being with them?
I went there when I was 23. It was remains of the old Bohemia, that's what it really was. And I just watched and listened. If you were there at 7 o'clock, you simply sat down to dinner. Wonderful food. They were friends of Elizabeth David, and Cedric used to illustrate her books.
And were they great raconteurs? Were they very...
outlandish, absolutely. Lett Haynes was. He was a great cook. And as he served this lovely food, which were out of a wooden plate, he'd tell stories. They were in Paris all during the 20s. They were part of the new post-First World War life there.
All these different and very interesting artistic circles in which you moved, it's very interesting that you should arrive within them as a young man, and what sounds like a very quiet and humble young man. Why do you think they opened up their circles and let you in?
No idea. I suppose I was charming, really. But I don't know. I have no idea, really, except that I can't remember not knowing them all, in a sense. There were lots of other young people, of course.
Do you think it was your good looks and your charm, then, that gave you an entrance?
I don't know. It's very difficult. I expect I was attracted to them, in a sense. But I think basically it was because of perhaps being a writer and chattering away. And there were several of us, not me. There were a whole group of us, all ages. There wasn't much age consciousness at all in those days. We all knew each other. And one way or another, we wrote and painted or gardened or whatever. That's right. I suppose in a funny sort of way, it was exclusive. But we didn't think of it as that in those days at all. I looked after the place here when John and Nash went on their painting holidays.
So you were dutiful and you were useful to them because you looked after their garden, or
look
you,
after
or
garden
you helped
and
like
pet
with
their cats. It just seemed kind of a normal thing to do. It was rather like taking somebody home in a car, or
yeah, giving someone a lift.
Cooking a meal, I say, but normal things, really.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
We had small expectations, financially speaking. We lived with huge simplicity and almost no money, in the ordinary sense of the word. But I suppose we made around us beautiful places. It was unselfconscious in a way. I read most of the time, quite honestly. Half my life was spent reading.
Now, you obviously were born in Suffolk, but a lot of these artists came from elsewhere in the country. Why do you think they were attracted to the Suffolk coast and also to the countryside inland?
It's the driest part of England, they say. Felix said 22 inches of rainfall. It's very bright. And somehow I've always felt that it's a place where you need to work. There's a Puritanism about it. It's basic, even from long ago, a kind of Puritan centre. There's severity about it. It's not soft. I feel it's very unlike Cornwall. It's unrelenting in its own way, I suppose.
The name of your farmhouse is quite unusual. Do you know the meaning of Bottingholms?
Well, the only thing I know for certain that it was there was a man called John Bottingholms in like 1375, a proper historian, not like me, discovered John Bottingham's, and so he must have lived here. And it's just a funny name. It looks straight out of Mervyn Peake.
He was another friend of yours.
I knew Mervyn a little when I was young, yes, in my 20s.
Could you just tell me again that wonderful story in your memoir of Christine's first arrival at Bottingham's, when she walks down the track and she meets a stooped old man?
He wasn't an old man, he was a postman. And in those days, the postman had to walk everywhere. She was walking down this track into this wilderness here. That when they bought the house, they had to slash the brambles to get to the front door. He said, "I'm the postman, my name is Death." It's a local name.
Do you have a favourite walk in the valley here? Is there
a particular
direction?
Yeah, I think the best one is down to the river, which is about a couple of miles.
And that's the Stour?
Yes, and it's very beautiful. And the constables used to farm all around here. This is John's uncle. And he used to walk through here to see them, call them the Wormingford folk. They're all in our churchyard. But there's a lovely walk down here to the river and to the little villages on the river. Extremely beautiful countryside, and it's heavily wooded, more so than when the painter was alive, they say. And it's got wonderful architecture. The churches are, and country houses are very beautiful, really. You meet very few people when you walk around.
This is from The Time by the Sea. It was Christine who told me of her first close encounter with this house. "I knew it for years," she said, "before we lived here. I used to see it from the track down below when we rented a cottage by the river. But I'd never approached it from the road until 1943, when a friend told us that it might be possible to buy it. The farmer who owned it had had it standing empty for 8 years, and he'd come to the conclusion that a few hundred pounds was really more valuable to him than just to see it falling into decay. So I came by Chambers' bus from Colchester and walked down the track, which in those days was a leafy bar with hedges meeting overhead. So I walked through a tunnel of greenery. I went on down past the house. It was actually impossible to get near to. The nettles and elders were right up to the top of the ground floor windows. There was no trace of a garden, no sign of a path. So I continued down the track and sat for a long time under a willow tree by a barn. And I thought it was the most beautiful place I'd ever seen, but absolutely impossible to contemplate as a house to live in. The idea of reclaiming it and maintaining it even seemed even more formidable. In this book, The Time by the Sea, the details of it remain vivid to me, and the friendships. What we were saying the other day, we were talking about Angus Wilson, who was also a friend of mine. Nobody reads Angus Wilson anymore, and yet he was ever so famous, and he was a very nice man, and he was brilliant in his own way. Isn't it mysterious in a way, isn't it? They're worth rereading, some of these people.
Do you think the 1950s are an overlooked time now, creatively?
I think they are. There's some wonderful poetry and stories written of that period, including like Elizabeth Bowen. Beautifully stylish, elegant stories. And there were quite a lot of literary magazines too, which took them. And sometimes they read on the radio to perfection, I think.
You're one of the very few writers in Britain who are in their 90s now and you're still writing and producing new books. Is it a challenge for you to remember the events of the 1950s?
No, not really. I hardly forget anything. Not only about that period, but almost any time. They don't seem like the old age, just part of one's life, really. Nobody can repudiate old age sort of thing, but I have no sense of being old. Because I haven't been ill, I think, that's right, touch wood. I don't feel that I belong to a particular time. I used to tell people don't join old people's clubs or do anything like that, and do a lot of work. Well, this is where I think artists and writers, musicians, people are very fortunate because they don't have to retire. In these last years, there's a whole industry focused on being old, and you should disregard it. Just work and be yourself and have people of all ages.
Visit audible.co.uk/guardianaudio to choose from a selection of over 60,000 titles. With Audible, you can make more time for books by downloading and listening to them wherever you are, whatever you're doing.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.